You're listening to another great podcast in the MyMac Podcasting Network.
It's time for the Geeks Pub. I'm Tim Robertson, joined by David Cohen. Hello, David.
Hello.
We've got the second tier of our bracket this week, and we'll get through that later in the show. We've got some cool stuff to talk about. I want to start with two different things, and they're both music-related. Disney Plus is coming out with a, I think it's November 1st, kind of a documentary about John Williams. It's called The Music by John Williams. And I don't know if you've seen the trailer, because it's been out for a little while, but it really kind of dives deep into John Williams and all the music he has scored, all the movies he has scored over the years. And it's, I think he's probably the most influential composer in the last 50 years. I don't think that could even be debated. I mean, the average person knows who John Williams is, at least his music. Name one other one. not very many people.
I'd say maybe Danny Elfman. People are very familiar with
that. I think the average person would not know his name at all. They would know his music because he's done some amazing stuff. But Elfman isn't
John Williams. Maybe Hans Zimmer.
Maybe. Yeah. But once again, I don't think most people would recognize him.
I think he's probably, particularly with things like Pirates of the Caribbean, Hans Zimmer has probably entered enough of the public consciousness that most people would recognize some of his music anyway. But you're definitely right.
No, would recognize his music. I'm saying they wouldn't recognize his name.
I think they would recognize his name. I think he gets bandied about enough.
I think you would hear. Yeah. I've heard the name before. I'm not sure where.
But you're absolutely on me. I mean, John Williams was a big composer for movies when we were kids, and
yes.
You know, yes, he's been around probably far longer and become, he was the first of the big blockbuster composers whose name really got associated with big movies that people recognize him on his own. And let's face it, I mean, guy whose career started with Jaws and then.
No, it didn't start with Jaws. He had actually won an award before that.
Yeah, I know, but I'm talking about people becoming familiar with him. Everyone, Jaws is such an iconic piece of music, people start to pay attention. Then, you know, he did music for a little science fiction movie called Star Wars. He did Superman. He did
Indiana Jones.
Indiana E.T., Jones.
Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, you basically look at Close Encounters of the Third Kind. If you look at, you know, some of the most massive movies of the last 40, 50 years, and you see his name right there in the credits. And also as well, you know, he's got the advantage because he's so successful. He's been approached for a lot of these big tentpole movies, and, you know, he gets top billing. Let's face it, for some of the more forgettable movies with the more forgettable soundtracks, one of the reasons you don't know who wrote them is because the soundtracks are forgettable and their name is buried somewhere deep in the tail end of the credits rather than being right out front.
I think that, number one, I'm happy that they're doing this before he passes away, because let's be honest, he's in his 80s.
Yeah.
He can't keep doing this. I mean, writing a score for a movie,
it's a big piece of work.
That's huge. I mean, that's so much work. And the complexity of his music and the fun.
Because
here's the thing with his music. He makes the movies better.
Well, that's,
and Steven Spielberg actually says that.
Yeah.
Think about Jaws. They show in this clip or in this trailer, Jaws without the music, and then they put the music in, and you're like, it's totally different.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the point. Most people think that the composer just basically writes the main theme, the stuff you hear at the beginning and the end. They write music for every single scene in the film, and they define that music based on what's going on in the scene, and sound and the music is a really important part of how you feel about what's going on.
Absolutely.
I raised this a couple of weeks ago. I was doing some legal training for my judicial role, and so I went down to the court and spent a couple of days dealing with training on domestic violence. It was a real barrel of laughs, but part of that was they showed us this scenario of a woman who was effectively being, you know, gaslit and abused by her partner, right? And we got shown all these little clips, leading up to you finding out whether it was true or whether it's not, and we were meant to judge it and all that sort of thing. And I actually complained to the person running the course. I said, look, this has got music on it. I said, this has got music that's telegraphing, you know, who the good guy and the bad guy is. I said, we don't get that in real life. We don't get that in court. They should take this off because it's telling you what's going on from the music. You know, when you see the guy,
they showed the guy.
Yeah. Well, the guy, there was like, you know, like suspenseful music playing. You knew he was up to bad stuff, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And it's just, I said, this is completely ruining the point of this exercise. Because the point is, you know, you're not meant to know whether it's true or whether it's false until you get all the evidence. And in this case, you're telling us this guy's a bad one. You know?
What did they say about that?
They agreed with me. They said they would take that away. I don't know whether it'll change or not. But it was.
So I'm way into watching this John Williams thing on Disney Plus, no question.
Oh, yeah.
But I also sent in, because, and this passed me by, this happened like over a month ago. They released the theme to the new Fantastic Four movie. Mm-hmm. What's funny is that we've had, what, four Fantastic Four movies in the last decade? And we all agree they pretty much suck.
Well, so here's the thing, right? I mean, first of all, Marvel in general has had a very bad track record of producing recognizable music that you associate with their movies. Despite the fact they've done so many of these incredible superhero movies, there's only a handful of them where you could
the Avengers.
Yeah, you could hum the kind of the theme or the main score or something like
or
that.
Or you hear it and you
recognize it, you know what it's from. That was part of the problem with the Fantastic Four films, is they were, all of them were very, very generic. But one of the problems I had with them was that despite the name, the Fantastic Four, they treated them as a very, it was the mundane four always.
Right.
You know, this is the most intelligent human on the planet. And then people who demonstrate, you know, unique qualities in terms of loyalty and courage. Yeah. And doing the right thing and everything. That's really the Fantastic Four shtick, coupled with the fact that they have these amazing capabilities and powers. And you know, Reed Richards' intelligence is another superpower, and he has that before the origin story kicks in. Yeah. And yet all of these movies kind of treat it like as ho-hum. Oh,
just another superhero. Yeah. This guy stretches.
Yeah, this guy stretches. Like,
that's not his power.
You know,
his power is his intelligence.
Yeah, Johnny Storm can flame on and fly now. You know, he's going to fly around for a bit and be a bit of a dick. It was just...
And the best of the Fantastic Four has never been them fighting monsters and shit.
No.
It's been a sci-fi adventure. They're explorers. That's what they do. And their powers lend itself to that. But... at the forefront, it's really about Reed Richards' intelligence, and he is the one that's kind of leading them as a group.
But that's what makes them. The fact is they are a ready-built superhero team led by an extremely intelligent guy is what makes them fantastic. And none of these movies have ever kind of picked up on that at all. Now, what I like about this piece of music is this is kind of an epic... I mean, it's well put.
It has wonder to it.
Yeah, because it does that thing where it starts slowly and then it speeds up to give you the intensity and all of that. And immediately you start thinking, right, this is a movie that's going somewhere. It reminds me actually very much of a very underappreciated piece of music, which is the theme to Man of Steel, which I think had the same kind of thing to it. But the thing about the Man of Steel music is it felt like Superman music. You're meant to feel hopeful, encouraged, enervated by it, because you know this is Superman. He's the most powerful superhero of all of them. And what I like about this is the same thing. This is like, you know, this is not just it's going to be superheroes and all of that. This sounds like it's going places, and to me that has the right level of scale.
But here's
for what
the thing,
you want
though,
the Fantastic Four to be.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like anything else.
No,
and that's what I like.
Yeah.
I'm like listening to it for the first time, and to be honest, I've only listened to it once because I think it's the type of music that's going to work better with something visual, right? But just listening to it, knowing who the Fantastic Four is, gave me so much hope for this movie. I'm listening to it going, yes, this is the vibe that I'm hoping for in this movie. And the pictures that I've seen a few of them, they're going way back to the classic Ben Grimm look. And knowing how good of an actor Pedro Pascal is, I mean, he is a really good actor. Yeah. Really good. Knowing Galactica, Galagos is going to be a person.
Yep.
All of that, just I'm like, I think Marvel has been chomping at the bit to do this.
Do you think they're going to lean into the pointy hat?
Oh, if you don't, I'm not watching
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
So, I think this is all good news. I think Marvel's getting their shit back together.
Yeah, and also as well, this is a piece of music that's going to be memorable because every time you hear that, you hear the refrain of that theme, you're going to know Fantastic Four because it's going to stick in the mind. So
I'm hoping that they position the Fantastic Four as the premier Marvel team now that the original Avengers
replace the Avengers, move away from the Avengers. And within universe, that kind of works. Because within the universe, the Avengers have kind of, you know, they've done their thing, but they've kind of been discredited and the Avengers have always been a
team that you pull the people in that you need for the big mission to save the world. Whereas Fantastic Four is a core group of four people that, you know, are going to figure it out. If you know the Fantastic Four is on the job, they're going to win.
Well, not only that. I mean, from the comics, most of the time, Reed saw the threat coming before anybody else did anyway. I mean, he was ready to respond when it turned up rather than reacting. I think that was one of the problems with the later Avengers movies is it was always them kind of budding around Stark's place, you know, like, what are we going to do today? Oh, let's try and pick up the hammer, this, that, and the other, until it was a case of, oh, we've got something to do now. Let's go and deal with it.
Well, but that's always been the Avengers.
Yeah, I know.
Avengers,
but
just the name itself is they're avenging a wrong that was done.
But you can only play that story a few times, and I think that's what happened. The middle Avengers
been playing it for 70 years in the comics.
I know, but in the movies, I think that's why the middle one was flabby because it was more of the same. And obviously, then they kind of tied up the Thanos saga in a fantastic way. If you excuse the pun.
No, I agree.
But after that, you can't really, you know, when they've beaten Thanos, they've gotten through the blip and all of that sort of stuff. You can't have them go off and deal with the movie villain of the year the next time. And that's the real problem they have with the Avengers.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think this is, I'm super stoked for what they're doing. Of course, they did announce Spider-Man 4 starting to shoot next year. I think that's good. And it is the same cast, which is going to be good.
Yeah. The only thing I'll say is Tom Holland's getting quite old now.
He
still looks young, but he is getting quite old. So I wonder if they're going to address that in universe and actually make him an older Spider-Man, or whether he's going to continue to be playing the college kid. I mean, I think it would be quite interesting if they moved it forward a few years. You know, obviously everyone's forgotten Peter Parker ever existed at the end of the last one. It'd be interesting if he just basically, you know, dived down the Spider-Man stuff and basically spent a few years completely on the radar because of what happened and where it led him to.
Could be.
And he felt like, you know, he didn't want to be a Spider-Man anymore because it the cost was too high. And then he gets drawn back into it by Rhino showing up or something.
Interesting. I think that if they don't start setting up this Spider-Man retiring – and maybe guest star every great once in a while in the future, but retiring this one and bringing in Miles Morales.
Yeah.
I think that needs to happen. But here's the thing. The Miles Morales, that Spider-Man animated movie, there's a third one coming, are so good.
Yep.
I mean, it's going to be so hard to portray Miles better than that.
You say that, but actually, if you look at what they did with the video games, where they also had, you know, obviously Peter Parker and Miles Morales, and you know, obviously the Miles Morales game was actually originally meant to be a DLC for the main game, but they're doing Spider-Man 2 now. They've done Spider-Man 2 and they're bringing it to the PC scene. I thought that was a really good way of basically saying, you know, here's these characters, let's mix it up a bit and do something slightly different. And I think it really works. I don't see any reason why they couldn't do that. And it would be quite interesting to see an older Peter Parker played by Tom Holland effectively being pushed into the mentor role with Miles Morales. That'd be kind of cool.
But I think that'd be very cool.
But they haven't announced casting for a Miles Morales, so I don't know whether...
I think they're years away from that.
Yeah,
we're probably 3 or 4 years.
I think they should get Mahershala Ali because he's apparently at loose end because Blade is dead. Well, the old from Miles Morales.
It's kind of old, but you know. I watched Transformers 1.
This is the animated Transformers prequel.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thor himself plays Optimus.
Right.
And I had no expectations one way or another with it. It's kind of the origin of the Transformers, kind of. At least this group of Transformers. And Optimus and Megatron, they go by different names at the beginning of this because they're minors. Mm-hmm. They don't have this thing that lets them transform. And Optimus is the guy that's always trying to kind of stand out from the crowd and do something. He feels like he should be doing something, and his best friend is this guy, Megatron, and he always kind of pulls him into his schemes on doing stuff. And I didn't know how I was going to like it, because I kind of got out of Transformers after the first Transformers movie.
Yeah.
Way, way back in the 80s. The animated one where they kill off Optimus Prime.
Right.
That was the end of the best Transformers stuff. I did like Bumblebee. I thought that was a really good movie for a Transformers movie, but mm-hmm. all the rest are just garbage. So, and I've seen some of the animated stuff on Netflix, and some of it's okay, but none of it stands out. It's just more of the same. So I didn't know what to expect with this one. I didn't have a problem with Chris Hemsworth doing the voice of Optimus. That's fine. You got to change things up sometimes. I'll be really honest with you. This is a great movie.
Yeah.
I enjoyed every part of this movie. When it was over, I was like, I want another one. That was so good.
Yeah.
I'm blown away by how good this is.
Interesting.
Blown away. It's way better than most people would think. It really is. It's, in my opinion, including the one back in, like, what was it, 89, something, 88? This is the best Transformers movie I've ever seen.
Hmm.
And it's an animated movie. A very computerized animated movie.
So
there's no humans in this at all, by the way.
Yeah, because it's set on their home planet, yeah? It's set on Cybertron.
But to see how Optimus becomes who he's going to become from this cocky, I don't want to say teenager, but this cocky thing that kind of is always reaching for the stars, if you will, and his buddy who he's always dragging along, who has a little bit of an attitude, how they both become both good and bad, and who the Decepticons, where they came from, and the backstory, and oh, it's just really good, dude. I mean,
so did they explain how if they're on an alien, their own home planet, which is obviously alien planet. To Earth, why they transform into things that look very much like things from Earth?
There's flyers and drivers,
right?
That's pretty much all they say.
There's flyers and drivers, but
yeah, but so, they don't really look like. I mean, they kind of look like jets because you still have to make toys and shit and they have to transform. But no, you forget about that pretty quickly.
Okay. You don't even care. So it doesn't look really jarring when you see an 18-wheeler truck driving around an alien planet.
He's not an 18-wheeler truck.
Right. Okay.
He's a motorized vehicle, but it's not a semi. It's a big ass vehicle. Don't get me wrong. But they can't, those guys can't even transform until the last fourth of the movie.
Right.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's really good, yeah. It's 100% worth watching. It will change how you think of Transformers going forward.
Well, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia, because I was wondering how it did financially. And the Rotten Tomatoes scores are pretty high, 89% of critics' reviews.
I would say, yeah, what's the viewers?
Viewers are they haven't got the viewers views from Rotten Tomatoes, but Metacritic has given it 64 out of 100, and then audiences on CinemaScore gave it an average grade of A on A plus to F.
Yeah,
so
I agree with that.
It looks like people enjoyed it, but I don't. It didn't really get marketed very much, did it?
No, it didn't.
I saw a trailer for it, but it kind of came and went.
Well, I brought it up on this show, 3 months ago, and I said this looks actually pretty good. For an animated show,
so
it was better than the trailer.
Yeah, I will have to go out and see it. I will have to definitely get hold of it. Now I can see again. That would be nice.
It's on home video now, so you can.
Yeah, I can
Speaking of home, I've been watching The Penguin.
Mm-hmm.
I waited till they got a couple episodes into it. I didn't want to, you know. And I just finished episode 3, and they've got 2 more to go that I haven't watched. I don't know how many episodes there's going to be together. It doesn't really matter.
So it kind of looks in the trailers stuff like Sopranos and Gotham. Is that what?
That's exactly. That's kind of what it is. Yeah. If the Penguin is Tony Soprano, it's before he became the boss.
It's his rise.
Yes, and man. It's so good, man.
You know
it's
what?
Better than the Batman movie.
I'm which, really glad
by
to
the
hear
way,
that.
I went and rewatched that because I wanted to get kind of caught up. Because I knew that this show takes place like right after that movie. Yeah. And I know Batman's not in it, and that's fine. Because remember, in that movie, they had this great big giant flood.
Yeah.
And boy, they really play into that, especially in the first episode. And how it sets up some of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But wow, it is. It is really, really good.
Well, yeah. I mean, look the movie sets it up so that you know, in the best mobster. I mean, this is mobsters in real life. You know,
yes.
The head mobster is killed, and the lieutenants then battle to take over the territory and become the top dog. And obviously,
not really that.
It's not really that.
I don't want no.
No, okay.
Well, it is, but it isn't.
Yeah.
The family is being held together by. His brother,
right,
who is definitely not, you know, that guy.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really have the instincts for it.
So
it's kind of soft.
Does this look? I mean, one of the other great Penguin stories I always felt was what they did with Penguin in the Gotham TV series, which was I thought was really well done within the constraints of that show. I thought it was really well done how they dealt with the Penguin's rise in that. So in this one, are they leaning at all into the, you know, the camper aspects of it? Is it or is it remaining grounded? So he's not.
It's 100% grounded.
There's no umbrellas. There's no, dinner suits and spats or anything like that. It's just literally, you know, he's a pretty gross looking guy, but completely.
Well,
ruthless.
He's got deformities.
Yeah.
And you'll find out why he limps in this. And
okay. Cool.
And that's why they call him a couple people. It's a. Prerogative term, Penguin.
Yeah.
It's because of the way he waddles.
Pejorative.
And you can see it, you could see that it bothers him when people call him that.
Yeah.
It, you know, it's Colin Farrell, so you know it's going to be pretty well acted.
Yeah.
But
I remember seeing the Batman movie, and if you weren't told it was Colin Farrell, you would have no idea who was under that.
Dude, and it's not just a face mask.
No.
I don't want to give anything away, but you see him like 90% naked in the show,
right.
Which you don't want to.
No.
But it's the whole bodysuit, dude.
Yeah.
He goes all in. I've got to imagine that was so uncomfortable to wear, but oh, it's so good, dude. I'm amazed that they made this show and that they got casting right out of The Sopranos some of these people. It's really good. And the city... is definitely a New York / Chicago vibe. Some parts of it, I'm like, that's more Chicago than New York.
Yeah.
Others, I'm like, that's definitely New York. But it's definitely unique, and you do believe this is Gotham.
Right.
You get to see not just the dark and all that. No, if it was like that all the time, nobody would freaking live there, right?
Yeah, but that in the Batman movie. I mean, there were times you saw him doing stuff, and it was daytime. You know, even though he was the Bat.
But the problem with the Batman movie is the city seems a little empty of people.
Yeah.
And they do that with a lot of movies.
Yeah,
it's
a budget
Avengers
thing,
was good about showing that actually there's a whole bunch of people in New York, you know.
Yeah.
Most movies don't do
that. Those CGI crowds
that
cost money.
Yeah, well, there's that. this is a very living, vibrant city that Penguin exists in.
Yeah.
But they 100% took... It feels like 100% continuation of the Batman movie.
Cool.
And you don't need or want Batman.
No.
Because you know Penguin's a bad guy. No question about that. But you kind of root for him, but you don't. It's weird.
And do they...
Just like Sopranos.
Do they explain Batman's absence?
No, they don't really talk about Batman.
Really talk
it's
about
more
them.
About... Right. Well, because the news people do, because they see Batman.
Yeah.
But... it's about the aftermath of this terrorist attack.
Right.
That a lot of people die.
Yeah.
Including one main character's family is killed. And this is kind of his journey as well. And they don't sugarcoat it. or sugarcoat it at all. In fact, in the third episode, you finally see some of the reaction that this person has because of it, and you're like, yeah, that makes sense. That tracks. It feels real.
It's the Irish police officer, Officer Doyle, that you're talking about from the 60s Batman show, isn't it?
No.
Yes, it is. We all want to see what happened to Officer Doyle's family.
But no, this is really good. I mean, unless you want to start having a big time sink and watching this, don't watch it, because once you start, you're not going to want to stop. It's that good.
Well, I'll wait till it's completely done and then I'll watch the whole thing. I have no idea where it's available here in the UK, but I suspect it's on a source that I don't have. So
I'm sure if you spent 3 minutes, you'll find it.
I hope you're not suggesting I might do something illegal.
Of course not.
No, and especially not in public on the broadcast medium.
Never. Completely legal. We're going to switch gears here for a second. You and I are, you know, we grew up in the 80s. We were born in the 70s, but, well, I don't know if we grew up, but we came of age in the
70s. I'm 54. I like to think I've never really grown up.
Yeah.
All the main things
in my life, other than having kids, happened in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Driving, graduating, losing my virginity, all of that stuff, that was the 80s. So the 80s music is really, you know, the music. Because, look, in 1980, you and I were 10.
Yep.
In 1990, we were... we were 20. Well, so the 80s was our formative years.
You know what? This level of information sharing that you're giving to our listeners is really going to be knocking them off their chairs.
I know. So the 80s movies was a big part of our lives.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think the 80s movies did two things really, really well that I don't think audiences now really have that we had as teens and, you know, going into adulthood. And that was movies that really spoke to our generation.
Mm.
You know, we had The Breakfast Club and all the John Hughes movies.
Yeah.
There was a lot of movies that was geared, that weren't superheroes and all that stuff, that was geared to us growing up, becoming of age.
Mannequin, Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah. You remember when someone died and you hauled them around for a while and you found them with a plastic thing?
You know what, a couple of years ago, I explained the plot of Weekend at Bernie's to my kids, and the look of sheer, literal open mouth horror on their faces,
it's terrible.
So this guy dies, and they have to try and make sure people think he's alive, and it's a screwball comedy. It was just, and they're tying their hands to his wrists and making him wave to people, and he's got sunglasses on, and nobody notices that he's rotting, and it really speaks to some of the quality of movies in the 80s.
Yeah, well, I didn't say they were all great. But one of the ones, because I love The Breakfast Club. It was one of my favorite movies of
Pretty much all of the John Hughes movies from the 80s were fantastic. You know,
With a big asterisk next to Home Alone, because I disavow that one.
Do you? Really? I find that interesting. But, you know, Pretty in Pink.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I watch that between Thanksgiving and Christmas almost every year. I love that.
Yeah, movie. Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I
never liked that one too much.
You never liked it.
I don't like him.
You don't like him?
No.
You don't like Ferris Bueller?
Ferris. No. Yeah. I thought he was an asshole. He'd get beat up at my school.
Well, okay. But he'd find a way out of it because that's what he did. I mean,
he'd get beat up.
I think the thing about Ferris Bueller is we all knew a kid like that, a kid who was a bit of a dick, but actually got away with it all of the time. I think that was the point, we knew kids like that, and it was annoying because they got away with literal murder in some cases. I mean, almost like, you know, the things they got away with, and you just think, why has nobody just dealt with that boy? But anyway.
So, you know, we grew up with these movies. Yeah. And one of the ones that I always really enjoyed was St. Elmo's Fire, because that was the one where it's kind of the end of those movies and those type of characters. And it still had many of the big teen 80 stars in it, but now they're young adults, they're graduating from college, and they're kind of all going to go their separate ways. And you kind of see that they're not kids anymore. One of them, like Rob Lowe's character, At the very end, finally kind of grows up. The one girl who's always been in love with him, and she's nerdy, finally gets her shot, and she kind of grows up and lets him go at the end. It has moments that I really enjoy, and I always kind of liked it. I never really liked the theme that much, but whatever. The scene with Rob Moore and, Rob Lowe and Demi Moore.
Yeah.
Where that's where the name of the movie comes from, yeah. Is the speech that, you know, because she's messed up and he's trying to pull her through. It's so good. It was for the time. I don't know if it really holds up well now, but for the time, I really enjoyed it. And it was one of two movies that I always thought, I'd like to see these characters in the future. Whatever happened to them? Well, Rob Lowe and Demi Moore, and I guess they say all the other actors are in if they can get the right script, but they're trying to make a sequel to St. Elmo's Fire. And usually I hear sequel and I'm like, ugh, just do something original. But this is the case that I think that it could be actually really good if done well. You get to see these characters, you know, 30 years, 40 years later. What became of them? Because I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I have low expectations of them being able to pull off something decent out of that.
I don't know. There's some really, if you look at the actors that were involved in it and you get the right writer, I think it could be really good. Yeah,
but that's the thing, isn't it? Getting the right writer. You've got to get somebody who kind of wants to, I mean, this could go several ways. You either get one that's basically is a pure nostalgia play. So it's just purely a throwback to the original movie with whole loads of call outs and cameos.
No, I don't think it would be that. I don't think it would be that.
You know, it wasn't directed by, I'm afraid to say, it wasn't directed by John Hughes.
It was not.
No, Joel Schumacher.
I don't think they're going to get him to do it.
No, I don't think so, because he's the guy who ruined the Batman franchise. But, so it wasn't a John Hughes movie. But I don't blame you for thinking it was, because it was full of all the people who were in his movies. Yes. It was a Brat Pack movie. It was the last of the Brat Pack.
It was the last of the Brat Pack. Yeah. Which is why I think, because I watched that documentary on Hulu about the Brat Pack, which they didn't have enough of the actual Brat Pack in it to satisfy, you know, where are they now? Yeah. What are they doing? But that being said, I think a return to these characters would be very interesting. More than that, you hit them now, and then they make another one in 20 years when they're geriatric, whoever's still alive, they follow up. So you get to see three movies of these characters.
Yeah, that could be, but
that would be good. Look,
this, I mean, if you look at the names who are in this movie,
my understanding is they're all in.
Well, yeah, of course they're all in, because
most
of them are in the what's called the Hollywood twilight of their careers, and a quick nostalgia play to make a buck sounds like a great idea.
But which one of these actors aren't good?
I don't know.
Lowe and Moore, they're both good. Although Moore, I don't know. She had so much plastic surgery that worries me a little bit. Andy McDowell, brilliant actress. I love her. Yeah. Andrew McCarthy, he's decent. Ally Sheedy is great.
Yeah.
Judd Nelson, come on.
What's he done recently?
Who cares? It's Judd Nelson. Emilio Estevez. Everything he's in, I've enjoyed.
I think the problem is a lot of these people have not worked for some time, and there's probably a reason for that. I mean, apart from the, you know, the standard Hollywood thing of not employing older people. The difficulty is as you say, this getting the players in is one thing. Getting the writing right is another, and deciding on...
I trust these actors to not take... to not do this movie unless the script is good. Because I think Rob Lowe is in a position now in his career where he can just say no and walk away.
Well, yeah.
And that movie doesn't happen without Rob Lowe.
Well, you know, we'll see. I would probably say generally I'm a little bit more cynical than you. I'd want to know that the script is not just going to be a whole load of, you know, callbacks, or worse than that, kind of the way they update
their kids
it is,
are the way they used to be.
Yeah, that's yes. I mean, that's awful. And also, as well, the idea that, you know, everybody has changed from the people they were in the original movie to be something that very fits much more with modern stereotypes. So one of them's turned out to be gay, and Ally Sheedy's gone trans. And do you know what I mean? The sort of pap that sometimes Hollywood writers produce, where they have to shoehorn every single agenda into the movie to make it modern and you know, to make it relevant today. And I don't really like
the term agenda, but okay.
You know what I mean? Because there are some people who want to say, right, well, what are the issues that we're dealing with today? Let's shove all of those into this movie, right? And I don't think that would fit with the way those characters would have gone on the way they were, because it assumes that they've jumped in time from where they were at the end of that movie to today. And
are you the same that you were in 1989
I'm not, but the point is I haven't changed into the person I am immediately from who I was in 1989.
They can't show the movie have to have changed.
But the problem is the writers go, well, the way I decided they've changed is they are now like this, and they don't think about
the thing,
how
David, I don't know if you know this, but that's every single movie that the writers decide how these people are going to be.
Wait, yeah, you can to me, if you're writing this sort of movie, you've got to plot out a life journey for each of these characters.
It sounds like you're saying, I don't want these people to be woke.
I'm not saying that at all. If that's what they want to say, then that's absolutely fine. But if they make all of them like that, I don't think that will be true to the original characters, because I don't think all of the original characters would have ended up like that from where they started from.
These were very unique characters in this movie. Everyone was kind of going in a certain direction, and I am very interested to see how they got there. Andrew McCarthy's love for what's her face in this movie
Wendy. Is it Wendy? Yeah,
Wendy, whatever it was. Judd Nelson's girlfriend. He obviously has no chance, and he's loved her forever, and she finds out. And, his scene I will never forget, this one stuck out with me. He's cooking dinner for her and his best friend. Right. But he's really in love with, and he's just kind of over it. He flicks a cigarette into the food.
Yeah.
I still remember, but each one of these characters are very unique, and I would love to see where they went. I'd love to see a revisit of these characters done well.
But that's what I'm saying. I'd like to see something that's believable rather than let's just fit a whole load of current, let's make one of them MAGA.
But you could totally see Judge Nelson's character in this movie. He could have become a Republican like that.
He could have done. He was looking at going into politics, but then I'd want to know is how did he get from there to here without just saying, oh, we're going to decide he's MAGA.
But here's the thing. I don't think almost any of these characters now would be where you think they would have ended up, because very few people actually did.
That's fine, but it's got to be believable rather than just a series of decisions plonked on top of these characters. And I think that's the art of doing a movie like this, is you've got to believe that...
Well, you're just describing the difference between a good movie and a bad movie. I agree with you.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't want it to be crappily written.
Well, I don't know anybody who does.
Well...
I'm
sure there are plenty of execs in Hollywood who say we don't care how crappily written is,
Nobody goes in to make a bad movie.
No, but there's some,
even the execs who think
some execs think, oh, it doesn't matter. We've got Rob Lowe and Judd Nelson in that. It doesn't matter what it's like. People will come. All the people who love that original movie will come and see the new one.
There's not one exec who would think if I have those two people are going to come to see that movie. You just described a Hallmark movie. Well, nobody's saying that.
Maybe that's where it'll end up.
If it's good, I don't care.
Yeah.
I
enjoy a Hallmark movie every now and again. Who doesn't?
You know what I enjoy?
Go on.
The Legend of Zelda.
Yeah. Which one?
Yeah, I like that. Well, I bought the new one, Echoes of Wisdom.
This is the one with actually has a legend about Zelda in it.
Yes. So the game. I've only played about 5 minutes, 10 minutes of the game so far. Ran out of time. But you start as Link and you're going to rescue her. Something happens.
Shocker.
And then he's gone. And now you're Zelda.
Yeah.
And I think that's a unique take. I love the aesthetics of the game. It's very cartoon. The mechanics of playing the game is easy and fun.
It
looks fantastic.
The trailers I've seen, it kind of looks like they took the aesthetic for that remake of Link's Awakening they did, but
they
kind
of
expanded it out a bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a good way. Yeah. I'm even 5 minutes in, I'm looking forward to getting back to playing it, but
it's very hard to imagine Nintendo ever turning out a bad Zelda game.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's the same thing with Mario.
Yeah.
You know, you say whatever you want about the game industry right now, and there's a lot of negative about it.
Yeah.
But what you can always count on is when it comes to their own characters, I'm not saying every Switch game is good, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But when it comes to their own characters, Mario, Zelda, and really those are the two big ones, let's be honest, it's going to be good. They're going to take the time. They're going to make a fun game, very approachable. Yeah, I just spent $60 for this game, which kind of sucks. That's a lot of money. But I've been paying $60 for games for two decades now, so that's not a big deal. As long as it's fun. There's too many times that I've spent the money on a game and gave up after an hour because it's just not interesting or the controls are hard and complex and, you know, that kind of thing. Yes. And I don't want to play with a bunch of, you know, 16-year-olds online in a game.
Yeah.
I just want to pick it up, play it for a little while, and put it away until I want to play
it again. I'll tell you, Alexander purchased the new Mario Party game.
That looks interesting.
Yeah? So Alexander got it. And I have to say, I know I've not played this game myself, but when we get a game like this, yeah, what my wife and kids like to do is they sit down in the kitchen where we have a big TV and the Switch, right? And they sit there on the sofa and they play each other on these party games. They absolutely adore them. And I sit...
Don't you love listening to them laugh and push each other?
Exactly, and, you know, and they get into arguments. Oh, you're not playing fair, this, that, and the other, right? And I watch these games, and the thing is, everyone thinks all these party games, it's all mini games and everything. The craft in these mini games is astonishing. The level of ideas, because I've seen all of them, because they tend to buy them, they tend to play them. And every single one is fresh and new. They've got different ideas, different mechanics, and you just look at that, and you just have to take your hat off, your Mario cap off to Nintendo, and go, you know, you guys really know how to do this and keep these things.
Hey, David, talk about
that
for a second. I got to step away from the mic for 1 second.
So they were playing this this mini game where all the characters are being chased by Big Rock, a bit like Indiana Jones in the first Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you know, they're gradually getting squashed one by one. Yeah, until one of them's left, and then they get squashed. And I said, "Oh, you all lost." And they went, "No, it's whoever lives the longest wins." And again, I thought, you know, that's a little bit different, isn't it? Because ordinarily you would do that, and you would think, well, the one who was at the end would be the winner, but wouldn't get squashed. And yet they all get squashed because that's the mechanic of the game. I thought it was cool, and they've been having an absolute blast. I've got to be honest, I don't understand a lot what's going on. There's various different things with coins and rolls, and every now and again a slot machine comes up and spins reels. Because I'm not playing it, I just kind of see it all go ahead. But, you know, these games are incredibly well-crafted, and it shows by the fact they keep buying them and they keep enjoying them. And they must have had, I mean, they've had it less than a week. They must have had at least 10 hours of play out of it so far, and they're nowhere near finishing it. Their money's worth. Yeah.
I'm glad they're getting my only issue with the party games was when it was the motion control thing on the Wii, I didn't enjoy that.
So, the Switch is kind of... I'm don't get me wrong, I'm sure there is stuff you can do with the Joy-Cons in there. But, you know, this is the beauty of the Switch platform now, is they have a couple of different form factors. So they can't rely on the motion stuff, because some people might be playing on Switch Lite and it doesn't work on there. So
I had to step away because I realized I left the creamer for my coffee out on the counter and I didn't want it to get, you know, bad. What do you think about the Switch successor? Because the Switch has been up for a decade, dude. It's 10 years. I mean,
and they're still producing brand new content for it, and it's all good. I mean, that's the most astonishing thing about it.
I think Nintendo has proven, and they've done it for many years now, for decades, that it's not the platform itself, it's the game, stupid.
Yeah.
And Microsoft and Sony, well, less so Sony, don't get that. Microsoft, they keep buying studios and starting games and they cancel them. And it's not about, you know, the IP, if you will. It's about a fun game. And Nintendo, more than the other two places, understand that it's not the platform itself. It's not the fact that it's on a Switch or on a Wii or an N64 or Wii U. It it's about the games.
Well,
the game has to be fun.
Yeah.
Period.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is their first thing. I think what I admire about Nintendo is that instead of chasing horsepower, they have, starting right back from the Game Boy, they have looked at, if we can make a different form factor to deliver our games on, what does that give to the player? And I think I think what was really, I mean, we everyone was kind of thinking, because they kind of failed a bit with the Wii U, right? The Wii was a massive success because that kind of motion control thing was the first time we'd been able to do anything like that affordably in the living room. And it opened a whole new opportunity for different ways of playing games. And, you know, that Wii bowling game that came with it, the Wii sports game, I mean, God knows how many people who've never played games before played that just because it was something they recognized.
I remember stories at the time that they were putting Wii U's in nursing homes simply to play that game.
Yeah. Now the follow-up to the Wii U was not that good.
It was a misstep.
It was a misstep. But then they came back.
There were some really good games on it, though.
But. Well, that's the thing. It doesn't matter about the platform. There will always be fantastic games. The N64, for instance, wasn't a huge hit compared to the Super Nintendo that came before it. But, that was the first Super Mario 64 game where it came into 3D. That game has literally defined a whole new genre of games, even though the platform it was on wasn't that successful.
No.
And I think the smart thing they did with the Switch is they recognized that, you know, people want to play games with their families in front of a big TV. And then sometimes they don't, and they want to go off and take the game with them. And so they made a platform that does both of those things in one box.
And I think that the Switch, a successor that's supposedly going to be announced real soon here, is going to continue that.
I would argue, you know, we're now living through this renaissance of handheld gaming where we've got these handheld PCs and the Steam Deck and stuff like that can play awesome games. We always dreamed back in the day of, oh, I wish I could have a mobile Xbox 360 or a PS3 or a PS4. And effectively, we now have that. And I would argue the Steam Deck and all of those things that came after it would not exist if Nintendo hadn't invented the Switch.
Oh, I don't think there's any argument to be had. That I think you're 100% right. But here's the thing. As good as the Steam Deck is, and it's really good, I still think that the Switch is better.
Yeah, no, I agree. Because, frankly, the quality of the games you can get on the Switch... If we were talking about these first party titles, you cannot get a game like the Zelda games, the Super Mario games on any other platform, and you never will. And that's why, when the Switch 2 comes out, whatever it's called, I'll buy one, because I know the best first party Nintendo games will be on that, and I won't be able to play anything like that anywhere else.
That's right.
When I got my Switch Lite, I played and still do play a lot of games that I could now play on the Steam Deck. Right.
You know, it's funny when you think about, look, Sony just has announced a couple weeks ago the PlayStation 5 Pro, right?
Yeah.
I didn't even consider buying it.
Nope.
Not for one second that I thought, oh, that might be. No, didn't even think about it. When I know that Nintendo's coming out the Switch 2, whatever it's going to be called, it's probably not going to be called Switch 2, but whatever it's going to be called, I know I am going to buy it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be for the games.
Yeah.
Period.
And,
yeah, I'm in.
You know, when the Switch launched, it launched with one of literally the best games of all time, which was Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Well, a lot of people forget, though, that they had that for the Wii U as well.
Yeah.
It was released for the Wii U.
Yeah, they did.
But nobody played it there.
It was backported, because why would you when you can play it on the Switch? It was better on the Switch because the Switch was more capable. The reason
I actually bought two copies, because my son at the time, Cole, was, you know, what, 7, 8?
Yeah.
He was watching me play that game on the Switch, and he wanted to play it. And I had the Wii U. I still do somewhere. And he wanted to play it, but I didn't want him to play mine because I was playing the hell out of it. So I just went and bought the Switch U version, and he played it on that. And I remember him sitting on the couch just for hours playing it with, and let's be honest, the Wii U tablet thing, if you will, was pretty crappy
Yeah.
compared to the Switch. But he didn't care because it was such a fun game.
Yeah. And that's what it's all about. I was going to say, I played a lot of games before the Steam Deck came out. I played a lot of the sort of games I like to play on the Switch, you know, 3D shooters, those sorts of things. I wouldn't probably buy those on the next version of Switch, because I really want to keep that for the Nintendo games, because those are the best games for that platform. And I've got other options for playing those other games now. But the point is, you'll always want to have Nintendo, because that's the only way you can play those first party Nintendo games, which literally are some of the best games in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. Let's get into our bracket here, since we're getting real close to the end of the show. We're on the second group now. These are all movies or TV shows that won the first one, and so here we go. Yeah. The first one we've got is Guardians of the Galaxy from 2014 against Agent Carter. Yes. I think we kind of both agree who's going to win this, I do want to make a little bit of an argument for Agent Carter.
Yep.
Because I think Agent Carter is one of those Marvel projects that a lot of people simply didn't watch. It was an ABC show, so this predated Disney Plus. The lead actress is great.
Yep.
And she really nails this character. A lot of people forget how many movies and TV shows she was actually in. She was in a lot.
She still is. You're talking like she's retired.
I'm talking about the Marvel stuff.
Oh, the Marvel ones. Because Peggy Carter was a core part of the Captain America Foundation, and so you had to have her in a lot.
Just at the end of Avengers Endgame.
Yeah.
You know, he goes back in time, and see her in the 70s or so.
She's part of Steve Rogers' primary motivation for everything he does. Because she's part of his backstory. So yeah, that was kind of, it was nice to see. Agent Carter was a great show, particularly the first season. The second season, less.
So. Not as good.
It suffered because it was a Marvel TV project, and those all kind of withered on the vine, really.
They did,
which is a bit of a shame, because actually I think the character deserved better than what she got. It was a great show, absolutely. But you're talking chalk and cheese when you compare it to Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, that movie still gives me hope that James Gunn is going to do right in the DC universe. That's the one movie that you look back and see taking these characters that were never popular in the comic books either.
Yeah.
And making such an almost perfect superhero movie about.
Yeah.
And that he gives you just enough information on each character that you like each character and you understand them.
Motivations
are completely clear for all of them. And also, one of them just says, I am Groot, God's sake.
But the other thing was that in terms of world building, he took something that was very, very difficult to deal with, which was the whole cosmic side of Marvel Comics.
And nothing had done it in the movies to this point.
You just looked at it. And I mean, from the comic side, you kind of thought, you could easily think, this is unfilmable. There's no way you could make this realistic in a live action world. He absolutely pulled it off. Not only did he pull it off, he pulled it off with bells on. I mean, you just buy it straight away that the characters are flying into a
100%
giant dead god's head, and that's cool. You know,
you buy everything.
You
in this
buy
movie.
It, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really was a huge achievement, and has, you know, the series had its ups and downs as it went on. I still think the first one is the best one.
I don't think there's any question about that. And I think anybody who likes Marvel movies as much as we do would agree.
Yeah. But
the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie is just brilliant.
Yeah. It's
Guardians is moving on.
Tough for Agent Carter in this case.
And it's going to be harder for Guardians not to win this whole thing.
Yeah.
The next one we have, this one's a little bit more difficult. Darkman from 1990, Liam Neeson, who, by the way, just announced he's retiring from action movies at 72 years old.
It says something about Liam Neeson, the fact that he was still being offered action movies at 72 years old.
Well, I think he needs to have a discussion with Sylvester Stallone. I will say his show on Paramount Plus is really good. Tulsa, really good show.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it. But this is going against Jessica Jones from 2015 to 2019, three seasons. Let's put season two and three aside for the moment. The first season of Jessica Jones, I think, is... again, some of the best Marvel television ever made. It's so good.
I think it's virtually perfect again. And we talked about this last time when it was up against a tough, a tough draw against WandaVision, which is no slouch. But yeah, that first season is pretty much perfect. As a, you could see that being a comic book arc, and you're just swallowing it, going, this is just brilliant stuff. And they turned it into a TV show.
It surprised me that they would do so well. Well, they kind of did. I mean, the very first one, Michael, I forget his name, Bendis, wrote took a nobody character and made this series. I think he invented the character too. I could be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure that she was this superhero named Jewel, kind of like Dazzler.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she has a big fall. Something happens to her, and it's the Purple Man. And she becomes a private investigator, and she's got kind of mental problems because of it. PTSD, if you will. They took the best of that comic book and kind of adapted it for a TV without actually doing that series.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was brilliant. I like the secondary characters. It introduces Luke Cage. I think they acknowledge something that happened in New York in here.
Yeah, so they do.
Have a passing reference to the Avengers.
They do, and Daredevil did the same thing, which is they would talk about the fact that, you know, the Battle of New York.
Have you seen the new trailer for the next Daredevil series? Looks really good.
I haven't, because what's concerning me is that there's a lot of backroom stuff going on over that show, and it's worrying me. It really is worrying me that they're going to screw it up.
It's not me at all. I'm super excited.
Okay, well, I hope so. I mean, I love Charlie Cox as Daredevil. I think he's fantastic. But, you know, hopefully.
We'll see. Yeah. But I think we both agree Jessica Jones is beating Darkman.
Oh yeah. I mean, even though this was the beginning of Liam Neeson's famous action career, that he then had a 20-year hiatus before he started again. I agree. And you know what? We talked about how much we actually love Darkman. I mean, that's why it went through in the previous bracket.
Yeah.
But the problem Darkman has is that it tailed off seriously after that. It really did.
Yeah.
You know, and it was one of those Sam Raimi projects that, you know, Sam Raimi, he has this habit sometimes of doing something and then walking away from it, maybe coming back to it later, maybe not, you know, and some of the stuff he comes back to, it gets better at. And there are other things where he just kind of leaves it to die. And Darkman was one of those. So
it's okay with me though.
Well, yeah, that's fine.
Next one, The Flash, the series from 2014 to 2013 or to 2023 against 2022's Ms. Marvel. Now, I think Ms. Marvel is better than most people give it credit for.
Yep.
But man, the first 2 to 3 seasons, not so much the later ones where they started doing a whole bunch of crossover and stuff and got a little repetitive for me. But
Grant Gustin
as The Flash is probably one of the best castings I've ever seen.
Yep.
He's so good in it. The supporting characters are good, even though they got a little silly towards the end. I still think that first 2 seasons of The Flash is some of the best superhero stuff on television.
I'd also say in The Flash,
they didn't make it so CW-ish that first 2 seasons.
No, but I'd also say, even if you consider the entire run, and I don't know what you're talking about, but actually what they pulled off with first Arrow and then The Flash, because it was a spin-off from Arrow, effectively created what people now refer to as the Arrowverse, which is all these shows that share a continuity.
But remember, Arrow was very dark. Arrow really was Batman more than Green Arrow.
Absolutely, because you could tell where the inspiration was. And absolutely. Rich playboy who has reasons for being a vigilante. But the point is they did splash The Flash as a spin-off. And, they went for this completely different vibe. They really, 100% really
bright,
nailed
vibrant,
it.
Fun.
But also as well, it had a lot of twists and turns in it that you didn't see coming. I mean, they pulled a big switcheroo right at the end of the first season. And everybody was just like, oh, my God. You know, somebody you think is a core part of the cast turns out to be, you know, the bad guy. And they kept doing that all the way through. And what I liked about The Flash, even endured some of those later seasons where they had a lot more crossovers and they had spin-offs and all that.
Well, I felt like they were just using the Flash's popularity to expand the TV offerings.
They were.
I got a little bit mad about that. I'm like, come on.
Yeah, they were. And then, you know, they shoehorned
this crap.
When the CW acquired Supergirl because it was canceled by its original network, they shoehorned that in as well. But you know what? I kind of admired that because we've seen so many instances.
They did it in a way that it made sense.
Yeah.
We've seen so many
instances of these big movie franchises where they tried to build a universe and they've just screwed it up. And this little group of TV shows on a low budget TV managed to pull it off and make it look easy. I mean, whether you like the crossovers or not, the fact is you just bought into it. And they were also able to actually do an awful lot of throwbacks to all sorts of different people who played superheroes in the past. You know, so they brought back a lot of actors who played the same characters. And I mean, and they had the guy from the crappy one season or two season Flash TV show from the 90s come back, and he's Barry's father.
He played the role longer in this series than
exactly.
he ever did back in the
early 90s. And then he got to play Jay Allen, the original Flash as well. And he was really, Wesley Shipp was really, really good at it. John Wesley
Mark Hamill
Shipp.
Was
yeah.
in it.
Yeah, exactly. It was, I think actually as a general piece of television, and then also what it generated, I think The Flash is probably underappreciated for what it pulled off.
I agree. Well, I don't know if it's underappreciated. There's a lot of people who are petitioning that James Gunn use him as the Flash in the movies, and I could not agree more.
Yeah, I agree.
And they don't have to acknowledge the series. Just use the actor.
Just use the actor.
Just use him.
Yeah, that'd be good. Anyway,
but
so...
We both said shoehorn at one point, and I think that's my biggest issue with Ms. Marvel. Because Ms. Marvel came out in 2022... before Endgame, right? And my problem is, okay, so it takes place in the 90s. Nobody in any Marvel movie before that ever references her, right? Including Nick Fury, who had a close relationship with her.
Hang on, we're talking about Ms. Marvel, not Captain Marvel.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we're talking
you know
about.
I was thinking
we're talking
Captain
about.
Marvel.
We're talking about the the.
You're right.
We're talking about Ms. Marvel, the girl. Not Captain Marvel.
One season, they haven't done a second season yet.
I loved Ms. Marvel, but
I did too.
I think that I'd want to see a second season
It can beat the Flash.
Before it can beat the Flash.
I don't know if we're going to get a second.
I don't know whether we are or not, but that's,
although her dad is in Daredevil.
Right. Okay.
As a cameo.
As him, not as a different character.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's him.
Okay.
And Matt Murdock rescues him from muggers or something. You see it in the... And I thought, look at that.
I could dig a Daredevil Ms. Marvel team up. That could happen. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think Flash wins, though.
Yeah.
As much as I adore that show, and I really do, I think that actress was born to play that role.
Yeah,
she's fantastic.
Is. Yeah.
It's not as good as The Flash.
No.
But it's only had one season, so...
Yeah.
You know, Constantine, this is our last one before we wrap up this episode. Constantine from 2005, Keanu Reeves, is about to get clawed to death by 2013's The Wolverine, which takes place in Japan.
Yeah.
And I will still say it has one of the best openings of any superhero movie.
Not
as good as the Auschwitz scene in the original X-Men.
No.
Where you see Magneto as a young child being separated from his parents, and that's when his powers kick in. That was brilliant.
But
Wolverine.
This is a very short conversation. Absolutely.
Yeah. You can't even compare these movies.
Yeah.
You know, the Wolverine is one of the best comic
book movies. I think the only Keanu Reeves movie that could possibly, well, there's two. There's obviously the first John Wick or The Matrix. Those are the only two movies that we'd even have a conversation about going up against the Wolverine.
No, you're wrong.
My Own Private
Bill
Idaho.
And Ted's an excellent adventure. I don't know what you're talking about.
That's fair.
Well, I mean, it had George Carlin in it.
Yeah, it did,
It had Mozart, for Christ's sakes. What are you talking about?
It had Waterloo.
Talking about the ultimate team-up.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
On that note...
Genghis Khan was in it. Come on. What are we talking about? Genghis Khan would kill Wolverine. Come on.
On that note, we shall speak next week.
Yeah. Next week is Tech Fan. We hope to see you guys back. Apple's got some a week of announcements, they said, which is like, ugh, come on. So we're obviously going to be talking about whatever it is that Apple's releasing. We know it's going to be Max because that's one of the, that's like the picture of the announcements coming is the Apple or the Mac logo. I really wish Apple would go back to the rainbow logo.
Yeah, they're never going to do that.
Logo. They're never going to do that, but they should. It's colorful. It's fun. It harkens back to simpler, you know, time and technology. Where
the only way they would do that is if Tim Cook could figure out a way to sell it for slightly cheaper than the existing Mac logo.
Well, there you go. So I'll see you then, David.
See you then.
Oh, by the way, we'd love to get feedback. It's theshow@geekspubpodcast.com and check us out at Geeks Pub Podcast or mymac.com. See you then, David.
See you then.